From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some classic blues and rhythm and blues from the 50s and 60s. We talk with Bobby Robinson about his Fire and Fury record labels. A new box set CD features some of his best-known records, including Wilbert Harrison's Kansas City and Lee Dorsey's Yah Yah. Robinson discovered Gladys Knight and rediscovered Arthur Crudup and Elmore James. Also today, Anna Quinlan. She was the third woman to have an op-ed column in the New York Times. We'll talk with her about a couple of the issues she often writes about, daycare and abortion. And book critic John Leonard reviews A Philosophical Investigation by Philip Kerr. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Justice Department asked a federal judge today to dismiss a federal indictment against former Defense Secretary Clark Clifford and his one-time law partner Robert Altman, but the government reserved the right to bring new charges in the future. The indictment dismissed today accused the pair of fraud and lying to regulators about the illegal ownership of a Washington, D.C. bank by the Bank of Credit and Commerce. Clifford and Altman were the bank's top officers. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Justice Department action had long been expected, since Altman is already on trial in New York on charges similar to those in the federal indictment, and the 86-year-old Clifford underwent open-heart surgery last month. Moreover, the judge in charge of the federal case had indicated she would be unlikely to postpone the June 1 federal trial date. In seeking the dismissal of the indictment today, the Justice Department said that it reserves the right to bring new charges at some time in the future, but that to proceed now with the federal case would burden the New York prosecution of Altman. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
In Los Angeles, the trial of three black men accused in the beating of a white truck driver during last spring's riots has been postponed. The trial, which had been scheduled to begin on Monday, has now been moved to mid-July. From Los Angeles, NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
The charges against the men came out of the early hours of the riots as video cameras beamed to millions the sight of Reginald Denny being dragged from his truck and brutally beaten. The Superior Court judge today put the trial off at the request of defense lawyers. The defense has spent the past several weeks preparing a case for discriminatory prosecution. That is, that their clients are charged with more serious crimes than white defendants would have been. The three men, Damian Williams, Henry Watson, and Antoine Miller, face life imprisonment on 24 charges, including attempted murder. This case has been linked with civil rights trial of the four officers accused of beating Rodney King and has contributed to the tension here and the concern about possible civil unrest. What this postponement means for the city as a whole is that now L.A. will not be faced with two potentially explosive verdicts in quick succession. In Los Angeles, I'm Renee Montaigne.
A radioactive cloud is reported to be drifting across Siberia after what authorities have called the worst nuclear accident since Chernobyl. The accident took place at a nuclear weapons complex near Tomsk, about 1,700 miles east of Moscow. Authorities say a tank of radioactive waste exploded and burned, but that only one firefighter received dangerous levels of radiation. The environmental group Greenpeace said that several villages are at risk from windborne fallout. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained more than 19 points today. This is NPR News. Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson has withdrawn his name from consideration to head the NAACP. Jackson was one of several candidates under consideration to succeed Benjamin Hooks as leader of the nation's largest civil rights group. Jackson said he didn't want to take part in what he said would be a fratricidal political battle. The leader of the Rainbow Coalition was said to have both strong support and strong opposition on the NAACP's 64-member board. The board plans to meet in Atlanta on Friday, when they could name a new executive director. President Clinton's list of possible Supreme Court nominees has one less name on it today. New York Governor Mario Cuomo has written a letter to the president saying he doesn't want to be considered as a replacement for retiring Justice Byron White. From member station WAMC, Mike Carice reports.
Cuomo says the letter confirms what he had earlier told the president in a telephone conversation. The 60-year-old Democrat said he didn't know if Mr. Clinton planned to nominate him, but he wanted to make his intentions clear because of press speculation that he might be picked. Citing New York's economic problems, Cuomo said he could, quote, best serve by staying in New York to speed and strengthen the state's recovery from the recession. He also told Clinton he wanted to stay active in the nation's political process and continue to serve as a vigorous supporter of the president. As recently as yesterday morning, Cuomo was dismissing reports he didn't want to go on the high court. He's in his third term as governor and has indicated he plans to run for re-election in 1994. For National Public Radio, I'm Michael Carice in Albany, New York.
Macedonia was approved today for membership in the United Nations despite a dispute with Greece over the name of the former Yugoslav Republic. Greece has a northern province called Macedonia, and it's concerned that the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia might try to press territorial claims sometime in the future. Macedonia will be accepted to the UN under the provisional name the former Yugoslav Republic. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The record you're about to hear is the very first record made by Gladys Knight and the Pips. The man you're about to meet produced this and many other R&B, blues, doo-wop, and rap records.
In every beat of my heart, there's a beat for you.
Bobby Robinson produced Every Beat of My Heart in 1961. Robinson is one of the first African Americans to own his own record label. Actually, he's owned several: Robin, Fire, Fury, and Enjoy Records. There's a new box set of his records from the 50s and 60s. It features talent he discovered, like Gladys Knight, and performers he brought out of retirement, like Arthur Crudup, who wrote one of Elvis's early hits. When Robinson tracked Crudup down to record that song, Crudup was a migrant worker.
Well, now, that's all right now, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, baby, any way you do. Now, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right now, Mama, any way you do.
Bobby Robinson recorded bluesman Lightnin' Hopkins' biggest hit, Mojo Hand. And in that same session, they made this.
Me glory be, yeah. You know somebody been talking about me. Whoa, Miss Glory B, Miss Glory B. You know somebody been talking about poor me.
Also featured on the new box set are some of Robinson's hits like Wilbert Harrison's Kansas City, Lee Dorsey's Ya Ya, Elmore James's Dust My Broom, King Curtis's Soul Twist, as well as recordings by more obscure blues and R&B performers. Bobby Robinson got his start in the music industry in 1946 when he opened a record store, which he still owns, in Harlem, just a few blocks away from the Apollo Theater. He told me what records he was selling back then.
Well, I started off basically with the trend of black records. It was a whole new thing. The doo-wop thing came in about 48 or 49, and I just had opened a store, so I got right into that. During the period of the early 50s, I developed 13 doo-wop groups. I had 13 groups, and then I got into blues, rhythm and blues, and the first one thing and another, but I concentrated on rhythm and blues mostly. That was my forte, and I grew up with it. As the new artists came aboard and rhythm and blues began to catch on and became popular for the first time, then I was right on the trend with it, and I produced some of the early things that caught on. So I grew up with rhythm and blues more or less.
Well, let me ask you this. At what point in your career as a record store owner did you say to yourself, I want to make records too?
Well, I tell you, I was one half a block from the Apollo Theater. And as I went, I met a lot of artists from all over the country. In fact, nobody would dare come to the Apollo Theater, come in town, an artist that had a record without stopping by to see me. Everybody would tell them, if you want to know what's happening with your record in New York, you go by to Bobby Robinson. You better go stop by Bobby's place and find out what's happening with your record. So everybody came. I had a stream of guys just coming in every week. So it dawned on me that customers were coming to me, people out of the streets, and the entertainers were coming to me. Everybody coming to me wanted to know what about their records, what was happening, what was good, should they do this or that, this, that. So I was giving out advice and whatnot. So it dawned on me. So I said, well, if I'm such an authority on this music, I better get into it. So finally, I made up my mind, and I just went in and I started to rehearse some groups, local groups, at night. I closed the store at 11 o'clock, and from 11 to 12 or so, I'd lock the doors and let the groups come right in and rehearse right in the store. So finally, I decided on a couple of groups, and I took them down the studio and recorded them.
Let me skip ahead to 1959, the year that you had a record that made it to number one on the pop chart and on the R&B chart. And the record, of course, was Kansas City, sung by Wilbert Harrison.
Yeah.
How did you release this record?
Well, Wilbert Harrison came to me one day, and he said he'd had one record out in about 54 or 55 with Savoy Records that did pretty good. You know, it wasn't a national hit, but he did pretty fair. For some reason, Savoy was into a lot of jazz and whatnot, so he didn't record Wilbur again. And Harrison had kept complaining to them about he wanted to put a record on the record. So he made himself a nuisance, evidently, with Savoy Records. And Mr. Lubinsky was the president of Savoy Records, so he got mad one evening and got his gun out of this drawer there and drew it on Harrison and told him not to darken his door again, to go and record for whoever he wanted to call. Just get out of there and not come back. So Harrison came to me thinking that, you know, the man meant what he said, and he did mean what he said then, but he had 3 months to go on a 5-year contract. And Harrison didn't think to say, well, give me a release or anything like that. And the guy didn't think about it. He was just finished with Harrison. And Harrison was, well, that was it. He was finished with him. So he came to me and he told me, he said, I've been doing this record, Kansas City. He said, the people where I'm working out in Jersey in this club go for this record. They call for it all night. I have to do a song over and over and over. He said, and I'd like to record it. So I said, all right, since he was there, I said, tell you what, I have a rehearsal this afternoon, and I have some of my boys there. So come on down and let me hear exactly what the song is like and let the group hear it, and let's see if we can get a thing on it. And, you know, so we went out to this place, and he sat down at the piano. He played piano, too. So he sat down at the piano and started to do the song, and I had about 4 or 5 pieces of the band there, and I had the boys to come in behind me, and we got such a terrific sound that I got very excited, and I called the studio and set a session for the next day to record this song.
Let's hear your 1959 recording, Kansas City.
Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. They got some crazy little women there, and I'm gonna get me one. I'm gonna be standing on the corner, 12th Street and Bond. I'm gonna be standing on the corner, 12th Street and Bond, with my Kansas City baby and a bottle of Kansas City wine.
Now, the story with Savoy, what happened, since he was still officially under contract with him, although you didn't realize that, did they sue you afterwards for the record came out?
Only $1 million.
Only $1 million.
That's all.
So you had this number one hit, and you didn't get to really profit from it in the way you
wanted.
Well,
I profited from it because I won the case. It was a long battle. The record was an instant hit, and what happened was, it's the funniest thing, I when I recorded it, I went to my shop and played it that night, and everybody gathered around the door, and you know, but I didn't realize how big it was or how important it was. You know, they just liked it. So what I did, I had about a dozen metal demos made up. And I got in the car, my partner and I, and we went on a leisurely trip. We went to Philadelphia, to Pittsburgh, to Cleveland, to Detroit, and we'd stop and put it on station wherever we went. So it was going all together about 10 days. And we got back on Sunday, and this was late March, and it was raining and whatnot, and I caught a cold. So got back in the afternoon about 2 o'clock, so I went by my office, which I had locked up when I left, and we had a slot in the door for mail and whatnot. So I went back and just to check to see if I had any mail. I didn't know the record was a hit. I didn't know anything about it because we hadn't spoke to anybody. And so when I went to unlock the door, it made a big noise, and I pushed, and it was kind of heavy. I didn't know what the hell was going on. So I pushed the door open and looked behind it, and I had a barrel of telegrams. I must have had 200 telegrams just piled up in the middle of the floor. So I didn't know what it was all about. I started to shut the door and go back. So anyway, I picked up a telegram, and I found out I had a smash hit. Everybody was calling me, going crazy, you know.
My guest is record producer Bobby Robinson. There's a new CD box set of recordings on his Fire and Fury record labels. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is record producer Bobby Robinson, one of the first African-Americans to own his own record label. So what was it like for you to promote the records that you were producing back in the 1950s and the early 1960s? Would you go around the country in your car and play them for disc jockeys around the country?
Yeah, I'd go one way or the other. I'd get to New Orleans. I'd get a plane mostly because it was a long drive. And I'd go to New Orleans, and I'd hit the station, and I'd go hang out with the jockeys, and I'd sit up and they'd play records. We'd laugh and talk and interview me and whatnot. And I set a distributor there. And I'd break records. I'd go into Atlanta and to Miami and wherever, Nashville. And just that way, one by one, step by step, until we got established. And I kept coming with hits. And so everybody just had to have the records after a while. And the first thing I know, I was in the record business.
Did any of the disc jockeys expect certain favors from you to play the records?
Yeah, that went on. That got to be a big thing in the 50s. And
what did you have to give them?
Well, what it depended on who the jockey was and whatnot. A lot of jockeys wanted me to give them a deal on the jockey to come in to do a show. They figured that way they didn't take any money from me directly, and it was much more important if I did it. But yeah, to have an artist that everybody's calling for to go in and do shows for nothing for jockeys was an easy job. After all, the artists wanted to make money too.
So disc jockeys hope that you'd have your performer do a free show for them.
Yeah, if your performer got hot, you got a record out and the record got hot, then right away, disc jockeys, where they would avoid maybe being investigated or whatnot, they want you to give them the artist free. You know, they would pay their fare in and whatnot, and they come in and do a free show, and they didn't care if they do one song. They do the hit song. That's all they had to do, one song. And he said they can go back, you know. So a lot of that was going on, you know. It took a lot of hassling here and there and a lot of, you know. But I worked it which way I could.
Did you ever have to pay to get airplay?
Oh, I have, yeah. Oh, I've played a lot of guys to get airplay. But, you know, I kept coming with hits, and I worked with artists is much, much more than the average company but that didn't have hits.
Being a black record producer, was it more difficult for you to get your records played on white stations, records that you thought could cross over into white stations?
Well, yeah, it was impossible. You couldn't get into that group pop stations. White stations just wouldn't play the records unless they were forced to play them, you know. And I came up once in a while with strong things that were so strong that they just had to play them. So the audience demanded it. And Kansas City really opened the door for me in 59 because everybody played it. Everybody had to play it. It was number one for about 10 weeks.
Now, you've recorded a lot of blues-based music over the years. I want to play something that's one of my favorite recordings on the new Fire Fury box set anthology. And this is Tar Heel Slim and Little Ann, and it's a 1959 recording called Much Too Late.
I was wrong, Little Ann, when I drove you from my door.
Tar Heel Slim, he was an old friend of yours?
Yeah, Tar Heel Slim was, his name was Alan Bunn, and he was with, he came to New York with a group out of North Carolina, a gospel group, and he was a good writer himself. He's a guitarist, and he sang and wrote a couple of things, so he came to me, he had a few things, so I liked his ideas, and so I got together and recorded him. I had recorded him on one or two things before that record came out. And then his very first record came out after Kansas City. The next record I put out after Kansas City was Tar Heel Slim and Ann on a thing called It's Too Late. It was also a hit that came out of the woodwork, as they say, and it established him.
Did you grow up with the blues?
Yeah.
In South Carolina?
South Carolina, yeah.
Where did you hear music?
Well, on street corners, there were when I was small, my father would take me into town. We lived 5 miles out of a little town, Union, South Carolina. And on Saturdays, on the street corners, there were men selling household goods, anything, pots and pans and all kind of little items and whatnot. And he would use a guitar-playing blues singer to draw the crowd. And he would stop the singer, and he would hawk his wares and whatnot. And then he'd let the guy say, just a minute, we'll have old Puddle Johnson to do another number for you here. Just so and so and so and so. So I was fascinated by this. My father would take me there, and he couldn't go anywhere else. I'd make him stay there with me. and I would listen to this guy sing. You know, they would come on, and they would sing and play the guitar, and it had a big crowd around, you know. And I got fascinated with this music, and every chance I got, I followed guys around like the Pied Piper was leading me. Whoever was some blues singers around, I'd go listen to them, you know.
Did they lead you in places that young people weren't supposed to be?
Yeah, but I had to slip and go. I got a few whippings for going. I used to go to country frolics on Saturday night, and I'd always get a beating. I know it's going to get a beating when I get home. I'd slip off and go with some grown boys, and it was just way out in the country where they sold illegal homemade liquor and had fried chicken and whatnot in the places. They'd take all the beds and clear a whole room, and two guitar players would, this was unamplified guitar, just regular guitar, would get chairs and get in the corner, and they would play, and everybody would dance. And I was just so fascinated with this. I would slip and go. I know it's going to get a whipping when I got home, and I would slip off and go. And everybody got in there and get a couple of sandwiches and get a drink or two of that homemade liquor, and boy, the party was on. I was fascinated.
Let me skip ahead a bunch of years and go up to, I guess, the mid or late 70s when you started recording rap records.
Yeah.
Now, you started off doing doo-wop. You did rhythm and blues. How did you end up recording rap? You were much older than the generation of rappers that you were recording.
Yeah, well, rap kind of came about. It started in 76. As a fad, a lot of guys were playing records in the parks and whatnot in the summertime. You know, the cattle play out, they had little dances outside and whatnot, and in the local clubs, and they just started talking, you know, behind the records, they're playing, and just to have something going, they started to rap, and it's a thing that caught on, and I noticed it was getting bigger and bigger, and among the crowds in the Bronx and in Harlem. And so I was in another business. I was in the wholesale business, and I didn't bother much with it. So one night, Sugar Hill
The record label.
Yeah, the record label. The guy and his wife, Joe and Sylvia Robinson, was at a nightclub in Harlem there. They came down to see somebody. And a couple of kids got up and did a rap thing. They hadn't heard of it before. And she got fascinated with it. She got these guys and went and recorded them. And that was the Sugar Hill Gang. And I got mad with myself. I knew about it the 2-3 years that it had been around, you know. But I never bothered because I wasn't recorded at that time. I was in the wholesale record business. And then she came out this record, and everybody went crazy. They was grabbing it right and left. So I said, good. You know, I was mad because I wasn't the first, because I knew about it, and she didn't. So I sent the word out to some disco clubs that was meeting, you know, had the shows on weekends, 2-3 nights on the weekends, whatnot. I contacted disco clubs in Harlem and the Bronx and whatnot and told the guys I was coming around to get the guys together, all the rappers, and let me hear them. So I spent about 3 nights in the Bronx and Harlem listening to this rap and that rap and whatnot. So I picked out 2 groups, the Disco 4 and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious 5.
And they were one of the best groups, Grandmaster Flash. What did you record by Grandmaster Flash?
Super Rapping. A song called Super Rapping. They one guy after the other took over the rap, you know? And then we got the music going in the background, and the band just kept playing, kept a dance thing going all along, and the guys would take a break and this, that, and the other. So we had 2-3 rehearsals and worked it out. Just a off-the-cuff type of thing, more or less. And it was a smash hit.
Sha-na-na! Introducing the crew, you gotta see to believe. We're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 MCs. I'm Melly Mel and I'm rocking so well.
And I'm Mr. Ness because I rocks the best.
I'm Raheem Hutt in all the ladies' dreams.
And I'm Cowboy to make you jump for joy.
I'm Creole,
solid gold,
the King Creole,
playing the role.
Dig this with the Furious 5 plus Grandmaster Flash, giving you a blast, showed up class. So to prove to you all, we're second to none.
We're gonna make 5 MCs sound like one.
You gotta dip with the dive.
This so socialize.
Clean out your ears.
Open your eyes,
and then you pay at the door as a donation.
To hear the best sounds in creation.
It's the disco dream
of the main machine.
And when it cuts the side,
you see what we mean.
You say his name is not found in the Hall of Fame,
but it'll shock and amaze and make you feel shame.
It's a line from 11.
Are you still running your record store in Harlem?
Yeah.
How much time do you spend in the store?
Well, I don't spend much time now. My daughter runs it more or less, my daughter and my nephew. I'm trying to break them in to take care of it. I already have time off. I just go in every day and just check to see if things are all right. But I'm going to take some time and write a book. Everybody's after me about to write a book. I made a decision 2-3 years ago, but it's been like hanging, and I've been doing a lot of things. So now that I'm more or less free to do it, I'm going to concentrate on writing a book and get it out.
Bobby Robinson, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bobby Robinson is the founder of the Fire and Fury Record Labels. A new box set of reissues called the Fire Fury Records Story has just been released by Capricorn Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's another early Gladys Knight recording from the Fire Fury anthology.
Here comes the mailman, walking up the street, and it looks like he has a letter today for me. Wait a minute, let me look inside. No, it couldn't be from my guy, because he brought me.
Yes, he did.
I said he brought me.
Yes,
a
he
letter.
Did.
Tears. I thought we had a love so strong. It would take a lifetime to break us apart. Oh, yeah. But I found.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
from Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Anna Quinlan writes a New York Times column called Public and Private. She writes about the personal and the political. We'll talk about a couple of issues that are personal and political, daycare and abortion. Quinlan won a Pulitzer Prize last year. Now she has a new collection of her columns. And book critic John Leonard reviews A Philosophical Investigation, a new science fiction book by British writer Philip Kerr about a serial killer who kills other serial killers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The commander of UN peacekeeping forces in Bosnia is reported on his way to the besieged Muslim town of Srebrenica. Local officials have made the evacuation of more civilians from the town conditional on UN troops being sent in order to protect residents from Serbian attacks. Pierre Vickery reports from Zagreb.
UN officials in Bosnia say the force commander, General Philip Morillon, is attempting to reach Srebrenica from Sarajevo to establish an international military presence in the besieged town. The plan is to deploy a detachment of Canadian UN peacekeepers, a number of military observers, and a field hospital. The general's action follows an ultimatum by local Muslim military leaders linking the evacuation of thousands of trapped civilians to a beefed-up UN presence in the town. Sarajevo Radio said heavy Serbian artillery of Srebrenica, in violation of the latest ceasefire, had killed 3 people and wounded a further 11. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Officials at the Justice Department have asked a judge to dismiss federal charges against attorneys Clark Clifford and Robert Altman in connection with the BCCI banking scandal. But the federal government has reserved the right to bring new charges in the future. Officials said the request is being made in order not to interfere with the current prosecution of Altman on state charges in New York and because of Clifford's heart problems. A federal trial in Washington had been set to get underway the 1st of June. Clifford underwent open-heart surgery last month. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Ethics Committee today announced it has opened a preliminary inquiry into contacts between the office of Senator Orrin Hatch and representatives of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or BCCI. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a written statement, the Senate Ethics Committee announced that the Republican senator from Utah, Orrin Hatch, had requested in writing that the committee investigate possible contacts between his office and BCCI, the international bank that was closed down amid accusations of money laundering and other illegal activities. The statement also said that Hatch has provided the Ethics Committee with office records and documents. This is the second time that Hatch has requested that the Ethics Committee review contacts between his office and BCCI. The senator was reportedly under investigation by the Justice Department and New York prosecutors who were looking into his links with BCCI. Efforts to reach Hatch's office for comment were unsuccessful. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
According to officials in New York City, damage from the World Trade Center bombing, including lost business, will add up to more than $500 million. However, officials say that federal aid, along with insurance coverage, means an estimated loss to the region of less than $100 million. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 19 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. New York Governor Mario Cuomo has told President Clinton that he wants to take his name out of consideration for the U.S. Supreme Court. In a letter to the president, Cuomo said that he wants to continue as governor of New York to help in his state's economic recovery, and that to stay in politics would allow him to continue to support Clinton administration policies. Last month, Justice Byron White announced that he plans to step down at the end of the current high court session. Aides say the president is at least 1 month away from naming his nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Reverend Jesse Jackson announced today that he is withdrawing his candidacy to succeed Benjamin Hooks as executive director of the NAACP. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Jackson was one of several candidates under consideration by the NAACP board. Jackson's withdrawal was not unexpected. While his supporters on the board believe he would energize the oldest and largest civil rights organization, the NAACP membership was strongly against Jackson. Even though members supported his bids when he ran for president of the United States, they said he was the wrong man to head their group. They cited his administrative problems with Operation Push and the Rainbow Coalition. In fact, his opponents mounted a campaign they called ABJ, Anybody But Jesse. The 64-member NAACP board plans to meet in Atlanta on Friday when they could name a new executive director. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Members of the UN Security Council have approved membership for Macedonia after months of opposition from Greece. Under a compromise, the new nation is admitted to the world body under the provisional name of the former Yugoslav province of Macedonia. The application for membership now goes to the UN General Assembly, where it must be approved by two-thirds of its 170 members. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Anna Quindlen was the third woman ever to have a column on the op-ed page of the New York Times. She often writes about issues of particular significance to women. In her column called Public and Private, she covers the personal and the political. There's a new collection of her columns called Thinking Out Loud. Her previous New York Times column, Life in the 30s, was very personal, focusing on her life as a mother. Her editors convinced her to write it after she had decided to leave the paper to raise her children. So you can imagine that daycare is an important issue to her. When Kimball Wood and Zoe Baird were taken out of the running for the position of attorney general because they had hired undocumented nannies, Anna Quindlen wrote a column about what working women looking for childcare are up against. She, too, had hired an undocumented worker to care for her children. She told me why.
I looked over my files from the last time I interviewed somebody for a job helping me take care of our kids, which was about 4 years ago. And 11 people responded to my ad. And of those 11, one of them was an American citizen who actually has been working for several years for a friend of mine. But the very best one was a young woman who was in this country to marry an American citizen, but who herself was here on a visitor's visa from Ireland. I hired her. She now has a green card. We have totally paid any back taxes, which we owed, which was not very much because about a year and a half ago, she wanted to go on the books with us so that she and her husband could look toward buying a house. So that she was obviously the very best person to look after our kids, still is. But we didn't hear from very many American citizens at all. And as I said in one of my columns, I think that's because many of the women who interview for those jobs come from countries in which caring for kids for a living is kind of an honored profession. And in the United States, it's not.
I think there's a lot of baggage that comes into things when you hire someone to work in your home, whether it's to help raise your children or to clean the house. And I think there's just like a lot of very complicated class and often racial issues that enter into that. And I wonder if you've felt any ambivalence or discomfort at having somebody, you know, hired working in your home.
I haven't felt any ambivalence, except that I'm always keenly aware that this isn't really an employer-employee relationship, not only because Elaine works in our home, but because, given the fact that she helps care for my children, she's something in between a family member and someone who works with us. So that there are certain issues that arise in terms of her health and happiness and well-being that don't always arise in a standard employer-employee relationship. And I have to always be conscious of the peculiar middle ground which she inhabits. But she likes working with us very much. She's expecting her own child soon that we consider sort of half our baby. And she expects after her maternity leave to come back with her own baby to help take care of my three, which I think will be very good for her, very good for my kids and very good for her kid.
And you feel confident that she feels that kind of family feelings about you that you feel about her. Because I think one of the fears, and again, this is getting to the kind of like class ambivalence that a lot of people feel, is that you can feel very familial toward the person that you're hiring, but they might feel like, well, not the same feelings, that they're the hired hand.
I don't think that our child care person feels that way, mainly because we treat her really decently and we pay her a living wage.
I want to bring up another subject that you've often written about in your column, and that's the issue of abortion. What went through your mind when David Gunn, the doctor who worked at the abortion clinic in Florida, was murdered?
I was completely and totally unsurprised, because given the reporting that I've done over the last 2 years, given the level of escalating violence against clinics and escalating harassment of clinic workers, and given, quite frankly, the extent to which my mail has escalated in terms of violence of expression and hatred, there was something inside me that said, of course, and I'm sorry to be able to say that.
What kind of mail do you get when you write a column about abortion?
I get horrible hate mail. I get pictures. I get material suggesting that I'm not fit to be a mother. I get material that's filled with sexual suggestions, which is something I have yet to figure out. I just get horrible, horrible stuff. You know, we get packages sometimes from people, and it's very disheartening, because I can't tell you with what joy I grab onto a thoughtful, reasoned, intelligent letter from someone saying, this is why I think abortion should be illegal, because the vast majority of the mail I get on that issue is just horrid and doesn't add anything to human understanding, and I ought to add that it is almost unvaryingly from men.
My guest is New York Times columnist Anna Quinlan. She has a new collection of columns called Thinking Out Loud. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. New York Times columnist Anna Quinlan is my guest. You were brought up Catholic. Are you still involved with the church?
Yes. My children have all been baptized, and we're educating them in Catholic doctrine, and our eldest receives the sacraments, and so do my husband and I.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to you to have the whole family still be involved.
Very important. Very important. I don't think there's anybody better for my children to learn from about how to face the world than what's in the New Testament, because it teaches as well as I ever could about loving both those who are your brothers and your friends, and loving those who are different than you are and who might be ostracized by the rest of society. And that's really what I want my kids to know.
Have you ever written a column that has alienated the people who otherwise see you as the good guy, as being on their side?
I'm not sure I have in terms of the column I'm doing now. I suppose the closest I would have come is the recent column in which I talked about the overturning of the conviction of Kelly Michaels, who was convicted 5 years ago of having sexually abused children in the daycare center where she worked, because there are a number of people who are my sort of natural constituency who believe passionately that she's innocent and was railroaded, and I'm not convinced of that. So that might be the one, since I've been writing this column. When I was doing Life in the 30s, it was most clearly the column I wrote about deciding not to have amniocentesis when I was pregnant with our third child, because many of our readers felt that it was an anti-choice column.
What were your reasons for not wanting amniocentesis?
Because my husband and I had made the decision that no matter what the amnio told us about the condition of the fetus, that we intended to go through with the pregnancy. And therefore, there didn't seem to be a real compelling reason to take the very slight risk of miscarriage involved in amnio to find out something that would not change our attitude toward the pregnancy.
Did people not want to give you the right to be pro-choice yet decide that you didn't want to have an abortion yourself?
I think that people thought that I was advocating this for other people, when in fact what I was trying to say about amnio is that in some sense it has no longer been a choice. It is taken for granted that you're going to have it. And without, in some cases, enough information both about that slight risk of miscarriage and about the limitations of what it can tell you. I've had women tell me that because they had amnio, they know that their baby is healthy, when in fact it reveals a fairly limited range of defects in the fetus, and it cannot tell you often how bad those defects are. So that, for example, it can tell you that you're going to have a child who has Down syndrome, but it can't tell you whether that child will be moderately, severely, or mildly retarded. And I think for some people, that would really affect their decision. So I think doctors have to be much better about filling women in, not only about what amnio does, but about what it can't do. I don't feel that many of them are doing that as much as needs to be done, or were doing it when I was pregnant with Maria 5 years ago. And finally, we just felt that it was not necessary because we were going to go ahead no matter what the amnio told us.
What surprised you most about the type of response you got to that column?
I think two things were surprising to me. One was how clearly some people had misread it, and the other was the depth of despair and anger among people who had grown up with a disabled sibling and felt that sibling had basically taken over their family's lives. I received any number of letters from people who had a brother or a sister who had Down syndrome, for example, and said that they felt that they never had any sort of fair share of their parents' time and had huge responsibilities as the years went on because of that sibling, and that I couldn't possibly understand what that was like.
That's very interesting. I'm surprised that that's what you got. I wasn't expecting you to say that.
It really was sort of staggering. And then after I had Maria, I got several letters from women who were pregnant at the same time I was, didn't have amnio for many of the same reasons that I didn't, and did in fact have babies with Downs, and that was very, very difficult.
So did they say they were sorry they didn't have it?
Some did, and others said no, that they loved their baby, and that they were deeply offended when people said to them, well, didn't you have the test? And so the obvious answer would have been, well, if you would have had the test, you wouldn't be stuck with this child. I'm now on the board of the National Down Syndrome Society, and it's mainly because of all I learned and all I felt needed to be done after having written that column.
Huh. I want to ask you a little bit about your family. Your mother died when you were 19 years old. Was that sudden? Had she been ill?
No, it wasn't sudden. My mother died of ovarian cancer. It was about a year and a half from her diagnosis to her death.
Were you very close with her?
She was my mother in every sense of the word. I couldn't have possibly asked for a better one. And I actually was at home with her for the last 5 months of her illness, so it was a really painful time. I miss her terribly.
You were in college then?
Yes, so I took a year off from college when my mother was dying, and then right afterward.
So you had been out of town at Barnard College?
Yes, I came home.
Right. What were you going through in your life after her death that you just especially wanted her around for?
Well, I think there are clearly times, and it sounds so silly, when you just want your mom. When I was planning my wedding, I wanted my mother. And when I was having my babies, I really wanted my mother. And now that I have them, I feel that it's so sad that they don't know her, because she would have been such an extraordinary grandmother. But I think more than that, it's as though you lose a crucial grounding in your life. I mean, in the most profound and obvious way, your mother is where you come from. And when that's gone, you really have to find a way to be a fully independent person. In a sense, it's very scary when you're young.
Are there times when you see mothers and daughters together that make you particularly think about her?
Yeah. I mean, real little times. It's difficult for me when my friends are with their mothers and they're fighting with them, because there's part of me that wants to say, don't you appreciate what you have? It's difficult for me when I'll see, you know, a mother and daughter just out to lunch together doing real ordinary things. That still bothers me a little bit. To be perfectly honest with you, I think some of the curse is off of it now because I have children of my own. And so some of the things I would like to have done with my mother, I can do with them.
Right. I want to ask you about your Pulitzer.
A year ago today.
Did you say you won that a year ago today? So today's actually the anniversary.
Yes, I know that because it's the day before my wedding anniversary.
Oh, gosh.
Tomorrow's my 15th wedding anniversary. And Jerry and I were planning on going out to dinner the night before anyhow, but we just took along a whole mess of friends.
How did they let you know? They call you up? Or did your newspaper find out?
Western Union calls and reads a telegram over the telephone to you at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Honest. I didn't make that up. I know it sounds like it's in a bad novel.
Or movie, yeah.
Yeah, they read you this telegram that tells you that you've won the Pulitzer.
And did you say thank you very much, or did you let out a little yelp?
I cried. Actually, and
even more like that novel or movie.
Yeah, really. I mean, I couldn't help it. It's one of those moments that you want to freeze in time because it seems so improbable. But I was very, very happy, at least as much because I knew how incredibly happy it would make my father as for any other reason.
Well, Anna Quinlan, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Anna Quinlan writes the New York Times column Public and Private. A new collection of her columns has just been published. It's called Thinking Out Loud. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we're taking a look at that nuclear accident that happened in the Soviet Union to see what the international organizations that monitor this kind of thing are saying about it, and talk to a scientist about whether something like that could happen here with all our nuclear waste concerns. We're following up on the president's economic program. The senators have gone home for a holiday. We'll ask the Senate Majority Leader what he thinks is going to happen. Nina Totenberg is going to tell us about these will he, won't he, is he, or is he not being considered for the Supreme Court, Governor Cuomo. And the new biography of Benny Goodman will be the subject of an interview with lots of music.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Philosophical investigation by Philip Kerr takes place in London in 2013. This futuristic novel is part crime thriller, part philosophy lesson. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
Suppose that in London, 20 years from now, they have developed a test to determine which men among the general population are predisposed to serial murder. Not preordained, but predisposed. These men, whose identities are protected in a computer with code names like Darwin, Shakespeare, Aquinas, Dickens, and Spinoza, are invited in for confidential counseling and therapy. But otherwise, they're left pretty much alone, except when spotted anywhere near a crime scene, upon which the computer kicks out their names to the cops. Suppose that one such man, appalled to learn what he's capable of, decides to indulge his predisposition in a socially useful way. User-friendly himself, he cracks the computer code, downloads a list of other potential serial killers and proceeds, serially, to kill them. We already have a philosophical problem on our hands, having to do with free will and genetic fate. This problem is complicated exponentially when the serial killer of would-be serial killers begins to identify with and behave like and rationalize his actions in the language of the philosopher whose name the computer assigned him, Ludwig Wittgenstein. Now suppose that the new Scotland Yard inspector trying to track down this serial killer is a gynecide detective named Jake Jackowitz, who is a gynecide detective instead of a homicide detective, not only because serial killers usually kill women, but also because Jake is very much a woman herself, a specialist in intuitive reasoning, like pattern recognition, and in the habit, for various reasons, of hating men generally. Once Jake figures out that Wittgenstein has confused himself with Wittgenstein, how will she proceed? There's as much in this taut and clever novel about grammar and language, empirical statements, asserted propositions, pure idealism, conceptual error, and cognitive dissonance as there is about computers and genotypes. In order to appreciate Jake's methods of investigation, as well as Philip Kerr's many jokes, it helps to know some Plato and some Nietzsche, not to mention Kant, who is killed quite early on, and Descartes, who works for an advertising agency. In addition, we learn a great deal about Wittgenstein, including the fact that he enjoyed detective novels. The suspicion grows, as we read along in this one, that Kerr is up to something rather fabulous. First of all, VMN negative, which is how you test if you're a son of Sam, sounds so much like HIV positive as to be more frightening than coincidental. But it's as if Kerr were also arguing, in the middle of a thriller, that the real Wittgenstein killed off his intellectual fathers and thus murdered Western philosophy. Maybe not. Anyway, Jake not only has to catch a killer, but read Tractatus Philosophicus too, by which time we like her a lot, although we've developed grave doubts about her brave New England, where instead of capital punishment, they put you to sleep with an icy hypodermic full of limbo. Technically, you're not dead, and a permanent coma is more cost-efficient than life in prison. What this injection is called is hot milk. What this novel should be called is terrific.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed A Philosophical Investigation by Philip Kerr. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, laughing about love and sex in the age of AIDS. We talk with writer Paul Rudnick about his off-Broadway hit comedy, Jeffrey. It's about a man who swears off love and sex and then meets the man of his dreams. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.